Hi, I'm David Korn.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
And together we're Blogging Heads TV.
Yes. Back at you again.
Back at you again. Keeping it real on the lowdown and down low.
Keeping it low budget, at least.
That's for damn sure. Bob Wright, are you paying attention? I don't know how long I can keep up this free work. Maybe we should get... I ain't going to work on Maggie's Farm anymore as our theme music. And you can't see this, but my earpiece is jumping out on me right here.
Okay.
So, but we'll just make do. Sometimes you have to put up with adversity. The way the president of Iran... found out the other day. He went to New York City. He spoke to the UN, spoke to the National Press Club, which didn't get nearly as much attention as his speech at Columbia University, where the Columbia president, Lee Bollinger, showed him nothing but good old American hospitality by calling him ruthless, uneducated thug. And then saying, now we're happy to hear what you have to say.
David, let's get right down to the brass tacks here. What would you have done if the Iranian government had called you up and said, would you like to invite Mr. Ahmadinejad to your campus to speak? And you were President Bollinger, what would you have done?
I would have done it slightly different. I mean, everything he said, in terms of, the questions he put to him at the beginning, I have no quarrel with. I would have said, I would have done an introduction saying, this was very controversial for some of these reasons, and we invited you here, you asked to come, but we also invited you, and so we will give you your say, as agreed upon, and then afterwards I have some hard questions to put to you. So actually, I wouldn't have given him. It's a phony issue, but it's still an issue of how he's being treated. If you decide to invite the guy in, then you give him a chance to speak, and then you lambaste him with questions that I thought were hard and fair. I don't read the Arabic press because I don't read Arabic, but my hunch is that in a lot of the Muslim world, this is too easy a way to portray what happened. By focusing on this attack on him. That's just my guess. So I would have set him up. I would have sandbagged him.
If the goal, though, from America's point of view, is to not have him look like he got mugged, then you couldn't. Then setting him. Then your plan doesn't help that question at all.
Well, it does, because you give him his say. You invite him over. You let him say whatever he wants to say. I mean, they weren't obliged to give him a platform to begin with. But if you give the guy a platform, you let him say.
But that's my point. I think what I would say is I think it was wrong for Bollinger to invite him,
right,
and just to let him speak, and then for Bollinger to say, well, I'll make up for it so I don't lose all my alumni contributions by trashing the guy. Looks kind of cheap and sneaky and underhanded.
And
I think what they should have done is said, look, you're more than welcome to come here to Columbia and debate Alan Dershowitz or, Norman Von Horowitz or, somebody.
Jim Pinkerton.
Or Jim Pinkerton. I think that, I think that if Iran calls for the annihilation of another member state of the UN, then Iran... should not be in the UN.
Listen, I don't want to get in this debate with you, but some scholars have pointed to that "wipe off the map" phrase as being not an exact translation. But let's just stick to the larger point here, because look at it this way. I'm obviously not in favor of the Iraq War, but if indeed. Let's just stipulate, for argument's sake, that General David Petraeus is right when he says Iran is providing weapons to insurgents inside Iraq who are killing American soldiers. Now, we spoke to the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, when we were killing one another. We spoke to the Soviets and the Chinese when we were, having secret covert operations against each other. So that doesn't mean we couldn't have diplomatic talks with Iran, but whether a private institution such as Columbia wants to give a platform to someone who's leading a government that's involved with activity that's killing Americans, I see the argument for not doing so. But if you're going to do that, I think, in essence, agree with you. I would not like to listen to Alan Dershowitz for 45 minutes or an hour. But I would have happily let Lee Bollinger do the role. He was up to that performance. But I do think it looked a little bit like a sneak attack, and I think it cut away from his argument, the manner in which he did it. So I think you could have said, Ahmadinejad, we're happy to have you come here. You'll get to say what you want to say, but then we have some hard questions. You can call it debate. You can call it a grilling session. We're going to expect, Lee Ballinger will put them to you, whatever you want to put it. But, structure it that way.
As long as it's structured that way in advance and so it's transparent, so the Iranians can't say, hey, we were expecting hospitality and we got clobbered.
And the interesting thing was I thought that actually it gave Ahmadinejad a very crafty opening. I mean, he came up and said, I didn't expect to be trashed like this. This is not how we do things in my country when we invite people in. And I think I wasn't in the room, but judging from the crowd reaction, it seemed he won over part of the crowd for that. He then lost it when he said there was no such thing as homosexuality in Iran. But I mean, it gave him an easy, way to sort of, portray himself, from a dictatorial regime as a victim.
Right. But two points. Strictly speaking, he said, and I don't speak Farsi either. He said we don't have homosexuals like that in Iran, which I'm sure is true. They're very shy in Iran, as opposed to out and about. And the other point is just for the record. Is it Afshin Malavi, who's a fellow here at the New America Foundation, who's an Iranian or Persian himself? I think he might have even been born there, but he certainly speaks the language and has traveled there frequently and written a great deal about it, says that this attempt to parse out the wiped out from the pages of history quote from Ahmadinejad as something other than just physical annihilation is hair splitting and teasing it too hard.
Okay, well, Juan Cole, another Arabic scholar who knows Farsi, says differently.
Loggerhead TVs can go to either Juan Cole or Afshin Malavi or both, preferably, and decide for themselves.
Yeah, you just want to note that there is a dispute.
There's two sides.
Yeah, exactly. People can decide for themselves. Two points that I was thinking about regarding Ahmadinejad yesterday. One was, I thought in the end, even though Ballinger, certainly wins on points, as did the dean of the international school with his questions, I thought Ahmadinejad was probably a big winner where it counts the most for him. That's back home. All politics is local. I assume he did this because he felt it would play well back home. His regime, I was going to say administration, his regime is not faring so well these days. Petrol prices are really high. Something like 70% of the Iranian population is under the age of 30. The economy's in the pits. So, how do you spell restive in Persian? I don't know. In Farsi. So my guess is that he came here looking to show that he can stand up to the Americans, to the guys who overthrew Mossadegh in the 50s, who supported the Shah. He could take them, mano a mano, and I'm sure, the way it gets played by the Iranian media back home, it only has the highlights. And it's going to help him there, which is going to strengthen, I'm not sure how long it will strengthen, but will give him a boost in his standing. What do you think?
I agree with that. There's a piece in the LA Times about how the much-discussed, never quite figured out properly, Arab street.
How come they never talk about the Jewish street? And you can fill in your own anti-Semitic punchline there. But yeah, go ahead.
In any case, the Arab street, I mean, it's just, if some LA Times reporter interviewed people in Cairo and they said, look, Ahmadinejad stands up to the Americans, stands up to the West, speaks for us, and so in a larger kind of cosmic sense, one feels the creeping of a recalifatization going on in the Muslim world, where slowly but surely, under pressure from the West and their own internal purposes, they are finding the kind of unity that reminds me of Germany as a pulled together and unified. Ultimately, before 1871.
Oh, the invasion of Iraq might have helped with that.
I think it did. I wrote a piece for, of all places, the Jerusalem Post in January 2003, in which I made exactly that argument. I said, listen, you go in as liberators.
You were prescient, Pinkerton.
I was, but and I'm saying that now, for all the discussion of the Sunni-Shia split, and I certainly have no wisdom as to how one would reconcile that split, or even if one would even want to reconcile that split. I think that the popularity of these sort of supranational figures like bin Laden, And maybe not like Ahmadinejad, obviously.
Well, it goes back to like the old Nasser days, you know, pan-Arab nationalism.
Well, the difference, though, is that when Nasser was defeated in 1967, pan-Arabism kind of collapsed.
Yep.
Because pan-Arabism was based on sort of imported European fascist communist ideologies that had no real natural resonance with Arabs and Muslims.
And it was more secular back then, too.
The communists and fascists, they were seculars.
Yeah.
The Arabs and Muslims and Iranians are all saying, look, we need to go back to the old-time religion.
Yeah.
Is this
Lawrence, T.E. Lawrence's grand vision, you know, 100 years later,
Exactly, and it won't be good, from the point of view of the West, the idea that the Arab world is divided into 22 countries is pretty good in terms of divide and conquer. And they know that too. And if they can figure out some way to pull themselves together, there are 300 million Arabs plus 170 million Iranians plus another million, you know, what, 900 million or so Muslims on top of that.
Be careful with the use of the word conquer there. Teasing that out a little bit, the other thing I was trying to think about in terms of the Ahmadinejad speech is whether it helps or hurts those neocons who are pushing for some sort of military action against Iran while Bush is still in office. I mean, does he come across as an anti-Israeli nut who doesn't even, you know, believe there's homosexuality in Iran, and therefore you've got to make sure you can't give him the bomb? Or did he look like a nut who you don't have to worry about so much? What do you think? Or is it a wash?
I think that frankly,
does he look like someone you could actually talk to? Or not?
I think the Bush administration has already made up his mind.
And
I think they plan on bombing.
Okay, but any old bombing? I mean, it seems to me that I got an email today from a retired CIA official who actually agrees with you. He thinks it's very likely there's going to be an airstrike, but he also told me that, you know, unless you do a full massive takeout operation, it's not going to help, and that he believes, and this is a guy who just got out of the CIA not too long ago, that the administration is making decisions, get this, on the basis of bad intelligence.
Bad intelligence in terms of like where the targets are and how long it would take and so on, but also there's a basic, deep sort of fecklessness, if you will, about mobilizing a country for a war. You and I have talked about this many times in the past. When you really, really want to fight and win a war, you have a draft, you raise taxes, you spend a ton of money.
But also look at what, you know, Iran is a country. You know, it's ruled by fundamentalist dictatorial clerics, but there, you know, there is something of middle class, there's something of a learned professional class. I have friends who are Iranian here who have relatives back home who are doctors, engineers, you know, university professors who, you know, teach, you know, classical literature, and we're going to go in there and start bombing. What does that do to that society? You know, how does that end up really taking out the regime, or does it end up strengthening the regime? What is the really strategic game plan here if you're going to do something like this, and then what is the trigger in the rest of the Middle East?
Well, those are questions that the Bush administration has proven it can't possibly answer. What they can do is bomb people. And I think a week ago I would have said no, and maybe a week from now I'll be saying different, but right now I think it's kind of just all the kind of vibes you get, and this discussion about how the Israelis are, you know, supposed to attack first or something, and then the Iranians will retaliate against Iran, and then we attack Iran. I mean, there's too much thought being given to these discussions to make me think it's all smoke.
Maybe it's time to take out the old, not so old novel series of Left Behind, because this does, you know, get an agnostic like myself thinking about Armageddon. You know, help us. Let's move from these mighty geostrategic end of the world subjects to something a little more prosaic. Hillary Clinton setting a Guinness Book World Record when she went on five talk shows on Sunday.
I think the only one ever did it before was Benjamin Ginsburg.
Benjamin Ginsburg, in what capacity?
He's Monica Lewinsky's lawyer.
Yes.
Was he an important figure for a while?
Yes. And She went on 5 talk shows. She said essentially nothing on each of the 5. And I thought afterwards, you remember that ad that came out a few months ago, the 1984 parody of her that a website guy did who turned out to be indirectly connected to the Obama campaign. Remember that great ad?
The mashup. Yeah,
yeah, mashup. I thought that after, you know, these appearances called for exactly the same sort of ad. You could have her saying on air the same thing over and over on each of the 5, on Fox News, on Meet the Press, whatever, and then show an audience of robotic-like, you know, Democratic primary voters doing clapping their hands to what Hillary Clinton is saying. I guess this is meant to show that she can get on all the shows. She has discipline of message. She doesn't falter. She can act like the de facto nominee. Anything else?
Well, I'd say that it's also, I think the Clinton people have learned that her best format is Q's and A's. You know, she's unflappable. She's pretty good. She stays on message. She talks at great length when she answers. And I even think that you know, the strategy of not being in the studio in many cases is wise, because it lets her control the lighting better. And it's also hard to interrupt somebody who's not right in the studio with you.
Yeah, as we know on Blogging Heads TV. Stop laughing. I have a point to make.
Right. So I think
but I was going to say
that she did well. I mean, look, it's pretty clear to me that the only calling card, if you will, comparative advantage that Obama has left is he's raised a ton of money.
Yeah.
He doesn't come across as more experienced or more wise, or after a while even more energetic and interesting than she is. She's the one with the giant operation. She's the one who's got Walter Mondale, and I only mean this for the primary purposes as opposed to the general election, written all over her in terms of inevitability and everything.
I've been saying this, you know. My preference, you know, I don't do endorsements. My preference would be to see Obama run a great campaign, you know, somewhat renegade campaign, and blow her out and show that he has the experience and the sophistication and the stature to do this. And with every passing day, he's losing that chance a little bit, because he's going to have to, you know, create a sharper contrast.
Right.
And I saw them speak, along with Edwards and Richardson, at the SEIU political conference last week. And the SEIU is the big service employees union, 1.9 million members. Its endorsement is very important, and actually was leaning to towards John Edwards, who's done a lot of work with the union in the last year or two. But it was the best speech I'd ever seen Obama give. He got everything right, a lot of passion, a lot of down-to-earthiness, a lot of policy, you know, connected with, you know, with these Democratic voters in the audience, activists, union activists. Really, very, very impressive. And it was when I saw him most maximize that sort of rock star quality that people attribute to him, which is good in a political candidate. It's good to do that. And Hillary came out afterwards, and she was fine. You know, while he was an A+, she was an A-, a B+. You know, she hit most of the right notes. She talked to the crowd, you know, perfectly in acceptable fashion. Some people were excited, not as excited as they were with Obama. And that is, you know, there's not enough of a gap there yet for Obama to exploit. She's not making mistakes. She's not giving him openings on the war or anything else. And his performance, you know, while good, is still not good enough at this stage to blow past her.
I agree, and I think that the Hillary healthcare plan, you know, getting that out the door, as it were, and I think probably sort of cements her loyalty among enough Democrats to say, look, she'll deliver on this for us. She'll get national healthcare finally. She's learned from her mistakes. You know, I think she was very adroit at answering all those questions and so on all the shows. I do think, however, she made a huge mistake, and that is this vote against the move-on resolution. I think that will haunt her big time, not obviously in the Democratic primary, but in the general election. I think that Senator Webb and Senator McCaskill and all the sort of these younger red state Democrats were all smart enough to vote with Senator Cornyn on this thing, and Hillary was left there with, you know, the left wing of the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, I tend to think if this comes up in a debate in the general election and Rudy Giuliani or somebody wants to mention this, she'll say, you know what, I'm here to talk about the war. You want to keep it going, I want to end it. And I think that will
maybe,
trump
but,
this.
But how will Hillary debate 50,000 veterans who swift boat her in the fall of 2008?
Well, you know, with the same type of line, I think. I mean,
they get on TV. If they spend as much money on her,
they'll do it. They will spend the money and come up with the ads, whether it's the Move On ad or whether it's something else. I mean, they'll call her a surrender monkey.
If half of the Democrats voted with the Republicans on that condemned, yeah. And the resolution, the Cornyn resolution, did not mention Move On by name.
Well, I understand that.
And so, in other words, if Hillary, I think it's very easy to say that Hillary cares more about the sensibility of billionaires and bloggers than she does about the U.S. military. Because I know, I mean, I live in Northern Virginia, I know what the military thinks of Move On, and I know what they think of people who support Move On. And it's not principled, let's put it that way.
Well,
and those people are going to get out and vote. And in the wartime, when the military, ask John Kerry what happens to you when you trash the military in wartime. And so I'm going all the way back to 1971 and his appearance before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. That they never forgave him, and he never got elected president.
Well, I'm not sure those people would be voting for her to begin with, and I still think that if we're at the same position in the war as we are now, that will trump this. And I think she's going to have a hard time getting that vote to begin with, especially if she's up against Rudy Giuliani.
It's a question of intensity, and yeah. I think that's the main question is intensity. And the question is, I'm not saying she won't get elected president. She's got a lot going in her favor. I'm saying it was a mistake to side with George Soros and Peter Lewis against the military.
Well, we shall see.
Okay.
We shall see. But speaking about mistakes and presidential candidates, you had a breakfast, which wasn't a mistake, with Newt Gingrich, who is saying that he'll get into the race if he can raise $30 million in the next 3 weeks, which means, like, I'll marry Angelina Jolie if she'll return my phone call. I mean, it's completely absurd. I did the math. It's like 14,000 donors.
Harder
to get commitments than to raise the money itself. This is just such, you know, bullshit.
Well,
that only gets played because places like the Washington Times dutifully scribe down, dictate or transcribe what he says. And there he says, "Ooh, Newt Gingrich is thinking of getting into the race." He's, you know what? Does he have a book coming out in 2 weeks?
Well, a couple points. One, the Blocking Heads audience can be assured that none of this is scripted in advance because when one of us, and I'm sure it's me, many times misstates facts, there's nobody there to correct them before they blurt them out. Gingrich did not say that he needs to raise $30 million in the next 3 weeks.
If you can get commitments.
You get $30 million commitments by November 1st.
That's
clear.
5 weeks then. Raised $5 million money in 2 months.
David, commitments is not the same as raising it.
It's harder to raise commitments.
No, it's easier to raise commitments.
Well, how do you commit? You have 14,000 people.
I can say I'll give you $5 million. That's easy.
No, but you can't do that in a presidential primary. You need 14,000 people who will give you $2,300 each.
Right. I suspect. Let's unpack this a little bit. First of all, I had me and several, quite a few other reporters had a pleasant Sperling-esque breakfast, with Gingrich last Thursday.
What did you eat?
A muffin and some coffee.
What did he eat?
I don't think he had anything at all. I mean, I realize he's conscious of his weight, and, you know, his new wife, Calista, is anxious to keep him healthy and stuff. So I think he had, as I recall, he had nothing at all. Although some people were eating eggs and bacon, I can tell you that.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, it's a Republican crowd. And he said that he actually made an interesting point, which about campaign finance on the $30 million front. He said, "Look, what McCain-Feingold has created now is, in effect, an oligarchy, where people like John Kerry and Bloomberg, and if he were to run, which I guess he's probably not, but or Mitt Romney, who definitely is running,
mm-hmm.
can write themselves checks for millions of dollars."
That's always been the case.
But the point is, and meanwhile, all the rest of us, this is Gingrich talking, are stuck trying to raise it in $2,300 increments.
Right. Well, that wasn't McCain-Feingold. That's been true for...
Well, okay, it's the campaign finance law, broadly speaking.
Decades.
Which McCain-Feingold is... Because it mentions McCain, I'm happy to...
No, the point was, you know, the theory behind that was you can't stop people from using their own money, but you can stop Howard Hughes from, you know, giving five
okay,
million dollars to Richard Nixon.
That's an interesting theory, and I can understand the logic in it. I'm simply reporting to you and to the rest of the Blogging Heads audience is that the effect has been to make Mitt Romney an enormous player in Republican politics.
Right.
Where he probably wouldn't get anywhere, but the point is, anytime you talk to a Republican, say, listen, Mitt Romney is fourth in the polls. He's going down.
Yeah.
He spent $45 million at 9%. But people say, look, but he spent another $145 million, and right. Eventually you break through with that kind of dough.
Right.
And so that was what Gingrich said. Now, Gingrich, in his own mind, said, I need, after he does this thing called American Solutions, which is an online sort of video discussion seminar, which is taking place this weekend, he's going to then reflect on running for president.
This is just ridiculous. Go ahead.
What's ridiculous about it?
Just go ahead. He's going to reflect on running for president. Go ahead.
I think he is. He's going to see what kind of impact he had. And
impact on what?
Well,
how many people are going to watch this? I mean, Lindsay Lohan will have, you know, gets drunk and people pay attention. How many people in America are paying attention to his America Solutions, you know, webcasted videos this weekend?
Well, I've been impressed by the number of people who are signing on as video internet lecturers. I just talked to Bob Walker, a former Republican member of Congress,
right.
A very, very smart guy. Was talking about energy and the environment.
Are you participating? Are you giving?
I'm not.
You should be.
What's
his number? I'm calling him right now. Okay, Newt. Newt.
And in any case,
you're staring me right in the face.
What Gingrich has going for him is he's willing to talk honestly about in hard terms about these issues, like why are the schools no good? Why do our levees break? Why can't we win a war? Why is London eclipsing New York as the financial capital of the world? I mean, there's a four or five issues he mentioned, or another 100 he's mentioned in the past, that do kind of cry out for genuine, profound change to fix a staggering status quo. And
don't tell me he's tugging at your heartstrings and wooing you from Mike Huckabee. Are you sort of drifting? Is your dalliance with Huckabee over? Are you now sort of pining for the Newt?
I'm a crusading journalist like you. I'm neutral. I'm just saying that Gingrich is an interesting figure who always reminds anybody who listens to him that if we were really... It's what Peter Drucker says, if you really were serious about this, what would you be doing? You know, what would be the 10 things with a blank piece of paper to start over with?
Like when he sent out that memo saying the way to have serious political debate in this country is to make sure you use these words in describing your opponents. Betrayal, traitor, immoral, hypocrite. I looked it up the other day, because now he's talking about how this country's become too partisan. Well, isn't that like, you know, Britney Spears complaining that we're too trashy?
Well,
I mean,
come on. Here's a pure Gingrich idea. Now, you tell me if you think this is a good idea or not. He says that the presidential candidates, Republican and Democrat, should agree to after they get nominated, should agree to debate each other 9 times from September to November, for an hour and a half each, in one-on-one debates with no questions, no stand-up podiums. Okay. Good idea or bad idea?
9 may be too much for most of us. I'd certainly say 7.
Okay, right. Okay.
I think in the past I've said something once a week, you know, and get rid of the commission and the boring journalists and, you know, let them go at it.
Okay, then there you are. So you and Gingrich agree.
Yeah, no.
Okay, another one which I hadn't thought about before, and I thought this is an interesting point, is have the candidates now, including in their separate parties, Republican and Democratic, all 15 or so, or whatever is left of them, have them debate each other, not just within the Republican Party and within the Democratic Party, but debate across party lines. He said, this is almost a quote, so there's nothing more toxic to the system than people who spend, you know, a year or 2 years or whatever, however long it is, talking only to hardcore audiences of their own persuasion. So I think it'd be great to see, you know, Mike Huckabee debate Chris Dodd on you know, whatever. I think it would be healthy for both of them just to hear what the arguments are.
I'm so glad that now he's out of power. He has all these wonderful kumbaya ideas. It is so hard.
It's not kumbaya. It's healthy discussion.
Well, yes, but he was never in favor of it when it mattered. when he had a chance to lead by example, which as a parent you're told is the best way to lead, he did the opposite of all this. He was archly partisan. He looked to make Democrats out to be criminal traitors and unpatriotic. And now that he's out of power and he can come up with all these wonderful ideas. Well, I don't disagree with any of that.
Okay,
I salute him for that. But I have a hard time hailing him for it when he failed to do so when he was actually a leader, a constitutionally empowered leader of this nation, and he did nothing except try to make things worse. In this regard.
Well, in this regard, he would say, I was doing other things, I was balancing the budget, I was,
I know. I thought he actually made things worse in every regard, but I know he wouldn't agree with me, and you wouldn't either. But I'm limiting my comments to this regard, all regards.
You're limiting your
for power of argument to win the debate point.
You're sweet about the '90s to a few points. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Okay, but anyway, I'm happy to have him come in the race and explain how he managed to leave not one but two wives when they were sick. love to see him go on Bill Maher's show as well. Can I just give you an update on my latest obsession, which we talked about, I think, last time on Blogging Heads TV. I've written a few pieces on Judge Roddy Al-Roddy, who is the former head of the Commission on Public Integrity in Iraq, which is an independent agency that's supposed to, is tasked to go after corruption in the Iraqi government, which is now the Maliki government. And he was forced out of the job when he was visiting the United States a couple weeks ago, because he had started going after members of Maliki's administration. And they put in place a guy who was arrested on corruption charges 3 weeks earlier. Anyway, Judge Roddy is still in America. He had to leave his hotel because he ran out of money. The State Department has done nothing for him. They told me officially that they've talked to him. They've had official conversations with him. But I heard from Roddy Associates that was a couple of weeks ago, and since then they've done nothing for him. He's basically out there trying to, his friends are out there trying to beg money for him so he can stay at, motels or, rent a place. He's supposed to testify this Thursday before Henry Waxman's House Committee on Government Oversight and Reform. And in preparation for that, Waxman has asked the State Department to produce three witnesses, officials who worked on Iraq and corruption matters, and a bunch of documents that they produced about Roddy and his tenure in Iraq. And Condoleezza Rice said no. Waxman has sent over subpoenas, and they're fighting that out now. The hearing will be, as I say, on Thursday morning. And the interesting thing here from a political perspective is Roddy told me, and I presume he'll say this when he testifies, that it's his belief that the Maliki government is so corrupt and so dominated by criminal thugs that it is inoperable and ought to be abolished. And if you take a step back and think about the strategy that the Bush administration is pursuing here, which is creating a breathing space in order for the Maliki government to, get its act together and have national reconciliation and provide some essential services for the public, Roddy, without being political, he has no view on what should happen in terms of, America's support for Iraq and the war over there. But the extension of his view, the logical extension of his view is, wait a second, why are we fighting for this government? Why are American soldiers, sacrificing their lives for this government if indeed it can't get anything done for corruption, for policy reasons, for political reasons, for sectarian reasons? And when he testifies on Thursday, I expect opponents to the war will jump on that and will, raise that issue, even though that's not his foremost concern. It'll be interesting to see how Republicans on the committee deal with him, because he really, I had a piece recently someone described him as the Elliot Ness of Iraq, and it's going to be very hard for people to sort of slam him.
Well, just a couple points. One is, how do we know that he's, that he's not a Chalabi plant of some kind?
Well, other than that he has no pre-existing, affiliation with Chalabi, he's worked in Iraq for 3 years, with State Department advisors.
Where was he before that?
Well, he was a former judge. in Iraq for, you know, for 29 years. He was in and out of jail a few times. He was tortured by Saddam. Just, you know, one of those jurists who managed to survive. And the way they were generals, too. There are lots of people in Iraq. You know, a lot of people who were not with the government managed to survive, even after losing their jobs, without being executed. He was part of that class. And he got this job, I think back in 04, and he's done it for 3 years. The state, you know, there have been several reports attesting to his diligence. I've spoken to several embassy people who are not policy people, but corruption people, rule of law experts brought into Baghdad by the State Department and Justice Department, who all attest to his honesty, integrity, and competence. So one can always be fooled. It's always possible. But by all ways in which an outsider, such as a reporter, can measure such things, he meets the test.
And I'm sure you're a diligent, thorough reporter, yeah. And you care a lot about this topic, and not about this fellow per se, but about the overall topic of Iraq and American politics. You've written a whole book on this, and so I'm just as I hear you say, well, as I hear him say, well, he wants to get rid of the regime. Well, that's exactly what Chalabi wants. Yeah. That's exactly what Bush wants. That's exactly what Bush wants.
I've spoken to, you know, other people who think Maliki is just, you know, so corrupt he ought to go. I mean, he doesn't say he wants to see the regime go, and he hasn't said this until, you know, until recently, but he has said that, you know, that he believes that, you know, the government's functioning at a 2-5% level.
Well, because of
corruption and ineptitude and sort of purposeful or purpose-driven ineptitude. So that's what he's saying. Now, I've met him. I've talked to people who have worked with him for years, Americans, and, you know, everybody has the same reading. Maybe he has a secret political agenda. That's possible. But I'll be curious to see how this plays in the media here and how
the word, Republicans. That leaps to mind is Diem.
Well, that is the word that leaps to mind.
Diem, of course, was the leader of South Vietnam who was corrupt and incompetent and everything. And depending on who you believe, but most likely the Kennedy administration back in early November 1963, just tragically, just a few weeks before President Kennedy himself was killed, had a coup in Saigon that led to Diem being overthrown and murdered.
Right.
And we thought we were doing better by getting a more effective, quote, less corrupt, unquote, government in there. And, we all know the history of Vietnam after that.
No, it got worse at all. We couldn't work with him. We couldn't work without him.
And so the concern I have is that without saying anything nice about Maliki or anything about his lack of, you know, anything about his honesty or anything like that, it just would say that if he has a sudden accident, you know, dies, cuts himself shaving and bleeds to death or something like this, by just random accident somewhere in the next week or a few weeks, or gets overthrown or something, or a plane crashes or something, the next government who comes after that, unless it's run by al-Sadr or something like that, is going to have absolutely zero legitimacy, because every Iraqi will say, well, you know, the Americans didn't like Maliki, who did sort of win kind of half an election. I'm not a little fuzzy on exactly how you get picked to be prime minister of Iraq, but he kind of won an election in the parliament. Yeah. And the next guy comes in, it'll just be sort of obvious that this is like Blackwater's candidate for the president, for the prime ministership of Iraq.
No, this is really a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. If Maliki is not serious about, you know, having a national reconciliation government, I think the evidence is pretty clear that he's not that serious about it. In fact, the one problem he's having in Iraq these days, which, you know, doesn't get a lot of attention here, is that there's a developing amount of Shia opposition to him. It's not always Sunni versus Shia. It's secular Shia versus religious Shia. And I'm told he's leaning heavy on some of his political opponents within his own within the Shia bloc. And, you know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with that. So the question, you know, is he may not be able to govern, and the next person who, you know, and if he's replaced legitimately or illegitimately, there's no guarantee that the next person will do anything better with these same things.
The goal in Iraq should be national conciliation. Do you think that's a realistic goal by anybody?
Well,
anybody?
Well, it may be the bridge too far, which is one reason I'm for, you know, beginning to disengage.
Okay, but our, another argument.
There's no point in staying in Iraq.
No, I agree.
Unless you come up with a breakup.
There might be a point in partition.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
In which case, Maliki is a perfectly fine leader for the Shia.
It could be, yes. But if you are engaged in that. In that process, but we're apparently not engaged in that process.
I think the point of Petraeus and this Anbar strategy, if you give guns and weapons and aid and body armor and everything,
they're claiming they're not giving weapons. Oh, that's another issue.
I mean, I see my TV with weapons. They get something.
Well, lots of weapons left there.
Okay, fair enough. But I'm saying if Petraeus, as part of the Bush strategy, is to build up Anbar sheikhs.
Right.
And the Sunni, for lack of a better term, warlords in the Sunni areas, they're never going to swear allegiance to the Shia government.
Right. But yet at the same time, the operative strategy is breathing space for national reconciliation.
To say that there's different elements of confusion in the Bush administration would be an understatement. But I think in this particular case, I just caution all well-meaning leftists and liberals who think that the issue is corruption. The issue is division. It doesn't really matter whether Maliki is corrupt or not, or whether he's got a Swiss bank account. What matters is whether he is taking orders from Iran, which he probably is to some extent, and what matters is whether or not he's a schismatic Shia nationalist, which he probably is, which I kind of applaud him for being that. I mean, after all the Shia have been through in Iraq in the last 80 years, they should be an independent, sovereign country. And they shouldn't, and it would be horrible, and it make things go from the current debacle to even worse if we were to overthrow Maliki, put in some Sunni
I think it'd probably be a secular Shia
who had no legitimacy. I've been to Iraq. I'll tell you right now, the Shia, the women, all wear the veil. I mean, they all wear black. Mm-hmm. I really don't think there are, except maybe in Georgetown.
Right.
There aren't a lot of secular Shia in Iraq, in Iraqi secular Shia, except expatriates.
Well, we can.
So I'll be interested in what this guy says. I would imagine that he's going to have a lot of interesting stuff to say. And I applaud Chairman Waxman for bringing him in. And the stories about Blackwater and mercenaries and contractors, let alone corruption, I'm sure will be curling our hair for decades to come. But I just caution anybody who thinks, well, there is a political solution to this. It involves getting rid of the Maliki government and replacing something better.
I don't believe that. I've said for years now. I don't think there is a solution. I mean, it's hard. I don't think there is a solution to Iraq, and partition may be a measure to take that will have a lot of ugliness attached to it, and it may be what the parties in the country and in the region end up, resolving is the least of worst, or at least, somewhat workable solution. And they'll have to fight that out. And if that's the case, I really think, we need to withdraw and let others, draw the lines. But I, for the life of me, I don't see the installation of another government that's going to be able to sort of, pick up where Maliki left off and make the surge a political success.
I agree. And it is interesting to read the paper, about Belgium, to shift gears or slightly, and I know we're going to wrap up, but just to make the point, and that is Belgium, the Flemish and the Walloons, the French speakers and the Dutch speakers in Belgium have sort of realized, look, after 170 years of not being very happy with each other, there's really no great point in us being a country together. And so they've, front page of the New York Times, it's got to be true. There's serious talk about dissolution of the country. And I say more power to them. I say more power to the Kosovars to become independent of Serbia.
I say the same thing to the Vermonters. But please don't tax the Ben and Jerry's. and a lot of other places. But anyway, on that happy geography note, let's wrap up this edition.
Up. Very good.
Okay, and so, Jim, it's always a pleasure.
David, and awesome. Nice to talk to you. And
talking to you soon.
I'll put some links up, and we'll do this. Okay,
bye.
Bye-bye.